thank you very much, everyone, for coming. And it's a real honor to be a distinguished lecturer for the MAA. And it's been a thrill to be here in this room all week with the Teacher's Circle program that we're doing. Teacher's Circles are gatherings of middle school teachers and mathematicians to engage in problem solving. And we have six teams from a variety of places here this week learning how to do that, and we'll go back to their homes and start teacher circles there. We'll have about 40 of these going in about a year from now, and so it's a very exciting thing. Well, I always love to talk about primes and the Riemann hypothesis, as Ivar has mentioned, and zeros, and so I hope you like this too. So a prime number. Well, probably everybody knows what a prime number is, but it's a number bigger than 1, which only has 1 in itself as factor. So 11's a prime, but 91 is not. It's 7 times 13. And there's a list of some primes, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, and so on, up to 100. And then I wrote down some other ones that I like just because, like Ivar said, I was interested in the twin prime problem. That was the thing that got me sort of started in number theory. And here's some prime quartets where you've got 4 primes in a decade, and nobody knows if that occurs infinitely often, but it's suspected that it does. But that's, I don't know, it's kind of cool when you've got 4 primes like that. And then here's the primes, the largest primes less than a million, and then the first couple primes after a million. Right. And we have known for a long time that the list of primes is infinite, but we still don't know if the twin primes list goes on forever. And so just to get you, what is the oddest, 2, 2 is the oddest prime, right, so okay, and do you know this one? What's the largest prime number mentioned in the title of a popular song? Anybody know?
17?
No? 8675309. Okay. Okay, so really the story begins with just trying to count, how many primes are there up to some quantity, and that's sort of the basic, that's really the launching place here. And, there's 25 primes up to 100, so a fourth of the numbers. 168 primes up to 1,000, so 16.8% of the numbers up to 1,000. And it's 1229 up to 10,000. And so you can see it's thinning out, 25%, 16%, 12%. And, of course, what mathematicians want to know is sort of at what rate is it thinning out, basically. That's a basic question, right? So at what rate are the primes thinning out as you get larger and larger numbers? Well, here's a big table of just powers of 10 over here, and then the number of primes up to that big power of 10, and the ratio. So 10 over 4 is 2.5, and 100 over 25 is 4, and so on. By the time you get down here to 10 billion, it's like around 1 in 22 numbers there. Is prime because the ratio of 10 billion to 455 million, the number of primes up there, is 22, like that. Okay. So, but now what's interesting is if you look at the differences of these ratios. So from 2.5 to 4, that's 1.5, and from 4 to 5.9 is 1.9, and so on. You just take the difference here. From line to line like that, and this is the first clue into figuring this thing out, is that this seems to be settling down to some number around 2.3. Any guesses what that 2.3 might be? It's a natural log of 10 is around 2.3. In fact, logs will come up in this talk quite a bit, but mostly about taking logs of large numbers, natural logs of large numbers. And really, a good way to think about it is just 2.3, it's more or less 2.3 times the number of digits. That's just a good way to think about the natural log, as far as we're concerned here. And so, you know, if you take the square root of a big, we're thinking of big, huge numbers. You take the square root, and you more or less just half the digits. You just cut the digits, the number of digits will be in half, right? Or if you took the cube root, that number would have about a third as many digits as the original number. But if you take the log, it's really just sort of the number of digits times about 2.3, okay? So so the log is a function that grows very, very, very slowly. I mean, you have to have lots and lots of digits before it gets very big. Okay, so how do we interpret this then? So just, if this ratio is constant down here and you're just adding 2.3 each time, then the number in this column should just be 2.3 times, you know, the number of times you took that difference, right? And this column is just the ratio between these numbers. And so really, this number divided by this number should be around 2.3 times, you know, n, the number of zeros here, right? And so that's what this says. The number of primes up to 10 to the n is around 10 to the n divided by 2.3n. That's what we deduce from that last, from that table, that big table about primes. And 2.3 is about log 10, as you said. And so 2.3 times n, that's about the log of 10 to the n. 10 to the n has n or maybe n plus 1 digits, and its log is about 2.3 times n. And so the number of primes up to 10 to the n is around 10 to the n divided by the log of 10 to the n. Okay? Sound good? But there's nothing special about 10 to the n, right? I mean, 10's got nothing really to do with primes. Primes are just some sort of natural thing, and you know what base we're using, obviously there's no relevance to that. And so really, you might just put an x in here. The number of primes up to x is around x divided by the natural log of x. And so that's the guess that you would make, is that the number of primes up to x is asymptotic to x divided by log x. And that would mean that if you took the ratio of these and let x go off to infinity, you get 1. But so x over log x. And in fact, Gauss made that conjecture when he was, 16. And in fact, it's true, and it was proven in 1896 independently by two people, Hadamard and De La Vallée-Poussin. Amazingly, they did the same year. And so Ivars was mentioning that conference I organized was in 1996, was on the 100th anniversary of the proof of the prime number theorem. And so the way we should interpret this is, if you just want to think of this in terms of probability, it means that the probability that a number is prime is about 1 over log of n. Okay? And so if you don't know anything else about the number, just disregard everything else, then the probability that it's prime is about 1 divided by the natural log of n. So for example, if you have your phone number is 7 digits, and the log of a 7-digit number, remember I told you to take log, you just multiply the number of digits times 2.3, so 7 times 2.3 is 16.1, so about 1 in 16.1 phone numbers are prime. And we can illustrate that with a nice crowd like this. We just do, raise your hand if your phone number is prime. Okay, well, I guess that experiment failed. We could do the same thing with Social Security numbers, but I suspect that I would always get a similar response. About 1 in 20 Social Security numbers. And if you're just looking around for a 100-digit prime, which, I mean, you might do, you know, primes get used for security purposes and things like that, how far do you have to look? When you start at 100 digits, how many numbers should you expect to have to sample before you hit a prime number? And so the answer is about 1 over log, you know, 1 over log, and the log is 100 times 2.3, so 230. So up at, when you have 100-digit numbers, about every 230th one is a prime. Now, Gauss actually made a much more precise conjecture. So pi of n is kind of funny that we use, that this is the letter that's used, but pi of n stands for the number of primes less than or equal to n. So it doesn't have anything to do in this context with, you know, 3.14. But that's the letter the number theorists use to talk about how many primes there are. So pi of 100 is 25. Pi of 10 is 4, because there's 4 primes up to 10. And so what Gauss said is, well, you should just reason like this. If the probability that 2 is prime is 1 over log 2, and the probability that 3 is prime is 1 over log 3, and the probability that 4 is prime is 1 over log 4, so the expected number of primes you should have up to a big number n should be just summing up all those probabilities. Okay, so that's just taking, you know, you're ignoring that, you know, 4 and 6 and everything are not primes. Just add all these up without regard to anything else. And that this should give, that in fact this is a better estimation for the number of primes than the thing we had before. And this is actually the subject of the talk. It turns out this is astonishingly good. And the whole question of the Riemann hypothesis is why is this so good? It's to explain why Gauss's conjecture was so fantastic. Okay, Riemann sort of paved a way to possibly understand it, but we haven't been able to figure out Riemann's idea yet, and that's where we're headed here. And so the Riemann hypothesis says that Gauss's conjecture is accurate to half the number of digits, basically, so about to the square root. Okay. And so that's the first viewing we'll have of the Riemann hypothesis. Now there's Gauss, and you might wonder how Gauss came up with this conjecture. Well, it turns out that he did just an astonishing number of calculations. He made just huge tables of primes. And he used to spend an idle 15 minutes calculating the number of primes in a Kiliad. Anybody know what a Kiliad? That's a block of 1,000 numbers. So somehow or other, he could figure out how many primes there were in the next block. Now, these are blocks of 1,000 numbers up around 1 million or 2 million. So in that range, he basically got the prime tables up to about 3 million. They existed up to 1 million in his time, but he went well beyond that. And in doing all these calculations is where he came up with his conjecture. So I got to visit Göttingen a few years back, and in the library there, they have papers of Gauss. And one of the things they have in a sort of manila envelope there is a stack of these little cards where Gauss had written like statistics for prime numbers. And there was a whole pile of these things, and here's a copy of one of them. And it's primes on the primes from 1 million to 1,100,000. And this is all there was. There wasn't any sort of key to how to, you know, decipher what he's doing here. So it actually took a little figuring out to, you know, what in the world this meant. There were no notes that explained all of his little cards. But basically what he's done here is, okay, so you have a block of 100,000 numbers here where you want to know about the primes in there. Well, you break that 100,000 up into 10 blocks of 10,000. So each column here stands for 10,000, a stretch of 10,000 numbers. Okay? Now, 10,000 is 100 hundreds. 100 times 100 is 10,000. Okay? And so what he did was then, in each column here, you take your 100 hundreds and count how many primes are in that block of 100, and then total that up. Does that make sense? Let's see. So, for example, the primes between 1 million and 1,100,000, that'd be a block of 100, there's 6 primes in there. And those are they. There's 6 of them. And so that would add one to, we're in the first 10,000, and we found 100, a range of 100 with 6 primes, and so we increase this number by 1. Count how often that happens, and that happened 14 times, and this is one of them. Okay, does that make sense?
What happens 14 times?
Well, okay, so in the first 10, so if you go between 1 million and 1,010,000, okay, you take that 10,000, break it up into 100 blocks of 100, For each block of 100, you count how many primes. Is it 3? Is it 6? Is it 9? Is it 0? And then whatever number it is, you make a mark here. If there's one prime, you make a mark there. So two of those blocks had no primes. Three of them had no primes. Said that wrong. None of them had two primes. None of them had three primes. Two of them had four primes. 11 had five primes, and so on. Yeah. And then, so the column totals to 100. Each column totals to 100, because there's these 100 blocks. And now this is a weighted sum down here. So you would take, there's one block with 1, and then two blocks with 4, so that's 8, and then 11 blocks with 5, so that's 55, and so on. And you add all that up, and you get this weighted number, the 752 down here. Or 52. And then you sum across here, and this is the total, is 7,210 primes in that first block of 100,000 numbers after a million. And down here, he's calculated that sum of the 1 over logs. He's actually written it as an integral, but it's virtually the same. It just differs by 0.3 or something. And it came out 7,212. So his prediction was 7,212.99, and the real answer is 7,210. And for some of these, it was like right on it, and he would put a couple exclamation points or something. And then this way, you've actually, here you just total up the rows. And you're doing statistics here, and what you begin to see, if you look at this, you actually see a normal distribution appearing over here about how the primes are distributed about their average, or a normal distribution also called a Gaussian. So here's just explaining the same thing. And so when I first saw that, I wasn't sure what this table meant. And so I went to Mathematica and just made my own little table just to verify, in fact, that was, what Gauss was doing. Because I wasn't going to calculate the primes myself. So I had Mathematica, a computer program, calculate these things for me. And, sure enough, it was pretty clear then that this replicates what Gauss was doing. Except, actually, there are a couple little discrepancies, as it turns out. So, like here, there's a 13 and 27, and there's 14 and 26, and 8, 11, and 9, 10, and so on. So there's a couple little mistakes here. The totals are all exactly the same, but so is it Gauss or is it Mathematica? how do I check it? By using Maple, maybe. I don't know how Gauss got 1,000. Yeah, no, I did not check it. I think it would be too much. I don't have that much patience. Now, how do we know that Gauss did all this stuff? Well, his student, Anka, wrote him a letter, and Gauss replied. He had some ideas. Anka had some ideas about primes. Here's the letter translated into English. His student. Gauss replied to the letter. And so here's a letter dated December 24th, 1849, that Gauss wrote back to Anka. And he says, thanks for the letter about primes. I've actually thought about this myself. In fact, in 1792 or 1793, these are the ideas I came up with. So it was like, 58, 59 years later that we finally heard that Gauss had done this so far back and that's how we know the day that he was 16 or so then is because from this letter, and so he talks about his conjecture. This is the same as that sum of 1 over the logs. And in his letter, he made also comparisons and showed how good his formula was. And here I've made a list, so you can see just how good it is. So it's the same thing we had before with the number of primes, and then here's what you get from the conjecture. And here's the difference between the number of primes and that conjecture. And you can see it's just unbelievably small that you have this sort of simple analytic formula that can calculate the thing so quickly. And so that's the question, is why is that the case? Okay, and so we move on to Riemann. And Riemann basically gave us the insight into how to think about this problem. And it was at a time when complex analysis was being developed. And the answer sort of comes from there. But basically, what Riemann found is that there's another set of numbers that are somehow intimately connected with the prime numbers and sort of encode all the information about prime numbers and vice versa. So the prime numbers tell you about this list of numbers, and this list of numbers that Riemann found tell you about primes. And so it's very curious. I mean, these numbers, presumably they're not rational, or presumably they're transcendental numbers. Nobody knows, but like the first one is 14.13, blah, 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 and then 21 and 25, and so on. Here's the first nine of these numbers. There's an infinite list of these things. And so what in the world do these have to do with primes? Well, so I can explain it by looking at sort of cosines and sort of adding up some cosine functions. So here's just a graph of the basic cosine function. And now what we want to do is, so these numbers, we're going to call these gammas. We'll use the Greek letter gamma to denote these. And so gamma 1 is 14.13, blah, blah, blah. Gamma 2 is 21, and so on. Gamma 3. And here's the nine graphs of not of cosine x anymore, but cosine of the nth gamma times the log of x. And this is what it looks like, okay? And now, so here it is again, truncated at 7. And look at 7, there's kind of a tendency for these things to be negative. And now, I'm going to show you on the next slide what happens when you just add up all nine of these things. You get this graph here, and it has these, look at where these peak, these valleys are here. If you can see the numbers here, this is at 3, and 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19. So they're exactly at the primes. So that's a sense in which these numbers know about the primes. And so basically what Riemann said is, well, what you need to do is you need to understand this list of numbers. And that's sort of what the Riemann, that's what the Riemann hypothesis is about. Okay, now there's smaller things at prime powers. So 4 and 8 and, let's see, 16 doesn't seem to have one. Probably not, we haven't had enough of those numbers in, but at any rate. Yeah?
How did Riemann come across those numbers?
Well, I'm going to try to explain where that comes. So that's the thing, is to try to explain where that comes from. And so to explain it, they're involved with this function that called the zeta function. So this is a Greek letter zeta of s. This is what it is. It's the sum of the reciprocal. It's an infinite series. It's the sum of the reciprocals of all the integers. 1 plus 1 over 2 to the s, 1 over 3 to the s, 1 over 4, and so on. You just add all those up. And that makes zeta of s. Okay. Now, this sum really only makes sense if s is bigger than 1. Okay, then the thing converges and you can make sense out of it. And so initially, this is for s bigger than 1. Now, you may know this, I don't know if you do or not, but if you put in s is 2, this actually is sort of not related to the rest of the talk, but it's, I can't resist, is that if you put in 2 here and you take zeta of 2, the sum of the reciprocals of the squares turns out to add up to pi squared over 6. So did you know that? You did. Okay, very good. Something discovered by Euler. But it's actually, it's another thing that Euler discovered that's relevant here, which is the fact that you can factor this zeta of s, this series, you can factor it into a bunch of factors that, one for each prime. Okay, so how does that go? Well, you take this thing, this factored thing, and just picture multiplying it out. Okay, you're just a gigantic foil. Is that what you call it? Right? And well, to do that, you have to take one factor, one term from each factor, and multiply them all together. But really, you should take ones most of the time. From some point on, you should just take ones. But before that, you can take other things. But at some point, just take ones from then on. And so, like, if you took the 1 from here, the 1 over 3 to the s from here, the 1 over 5 to the s from here, and all the rest 1s, well, you get this. You get the 1 over 15 to the s that's in the series for zeta that has every term. Okay? And since every number can be factored into prime powers in a unique way, right, that's what you call the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, that's why you have this identity, okay? Is that okay? That's kind of amazing, but this is the starting point for why the zeta function is connected up with primes, is because of this factorization. And so that's a clue that this may have something to do with primes. And well, you can go a little bit further. This is actually a geometric series, and so you can sum it as long as if s is bigger than 0, you can sum it, and then you get, this is now a product sign, zeta of s is a product over primes. And so that's just a nice short way to write the thing, nice pretty way to write it. But it's the exact same thing as what was on that last slide. And Euler is the one who discovered the product formula. But it was Riemann who really made use of this and figured out that what you had to do was let s be a complex number. That's going to be the key thing. Somehow you have to let s be a complex number back in that formula, and you have to study where that function is equal to 0. That's what it's going to turn out to be. And Riemann is the one who figured that out. And it was just an amazing pioneering breakthrough in 1859, and it's led to just incredible amount of work since then, and still trying to understand the whole thing. Riemann actually didn't make it to his 40th birthday. But he was prolific in a short time and had a profound influence on many areas of mathematics. And today, the Riemann zeta function is really just the first of a whole host of zeta functions that are everywhere in like all kinds of number theory. There's the Dedekind zeta function, the Hasse-Wey, Hurwitz. There's L functions that are all connected with this. And so really, the Riemann zeta function is just the tip of the iceberg. And their study really is the basis for modern number theory, is trying to understand all these things. There's practically every kind of zeta function except a... So the thing that we want to understand the zeta function, the primes, is to actually locate the zeros of the zeta function, figure out the places where the zeta function is equal to 0. And so what does that mean? How do we make sense of that? We want to figure out where the zeta function is equal to 0. And we got a couple problems. One is that the series defining zeta only makes sense right now when s is bigger than a real number bigger than 1. And 2, what does it actually mean to put a complex number in there? How do you make sense out of that? And there's actually an easy way to overcome the first of these difficulties, and that is if you look at an alternating series instead of all pluses, then that will actually converge to the right of 0, and that's actually good because that's mainly the area where we want to look, is just to the right of 0. And that's closely related to the... Oops, uh-oh, what just happened? Now what? Oh my! Not plugged in. I plugged into a non-live plug. It shut down. Yeah. Hopefully, it's not going to reboot. Okay, so basically you just take the zeta function, you subtract twice all the even terms, okay? But from these even terms, you can factor out a 1 over 2 to the s, and then you're just left with the zeta function back. So 1 minus 2 to the 1 minus s times zeta is this zeta 2, And if it's zeros you're interested in, then zeta 2 and zeta will have the same zeros apart from easily identified places where that thing's zero. Okay.
That doesn't bother you that one side's convergent and the other side's not.
No, so it's like an analytic continuation. It sort of makes, it extends the range where you make sense of the function. And there's lots of tricks to do this. This is just a particularly simple one that allows you to move over one spot. Riemann actually figured out a way to make sense of the thing in the whole plane. But this gets you over to the right of zero anyhow. And then how do you deal with complex numbers? Well, if your complex number is sigma plus IT, it's admittedly a strange notation, but it's what analytic number theorists have always used. Then 1 over n of the s is 1 over n of the sigma times 1 over n of the it, and 1 over n of the it is cosine t log n by minus I sine t log n by Euler's formula. So Euler comes to the rescue again, and using logs and cosines and sines, you can figure out what that means, and so put it all together, and the thing actually makes sense. And like I said, Riemann discovered a way to make sense of zeta for complex numbers, except for s equals 1. There's a pole. It blows up to infinity at s equals 1, but it makes sense everywhere else. He discovered a relationship between the values of zeta at s and 1 minus s. It's called the functional equation, which is quite amazing, and figured out sort of how many zeros there are as you leave the real axis and sort of move up the plane. He gave a formula for the number of zeros. And actually did what his goal was, which is to count the number of primes up to any given number x, and he actually found a formula for that. It's really quite amazing. Now, okay, so where are the zeros? Well, so here's the plane, and there's no zeros out here because we have that product formula, and that doesn't ever vanish, and so there's no zeros out there. And then we have Riemann's functional equation, which says there's no zeros over here, complex zeros anyway, because they would be related to a zero over here if there were one. So they're all here in this strip between 0 and 1, and that's called the critical strip. And they're symmetrically located about the critical line here, the 1/2 line. They should be the same left and right and the same up and down. And so that's what Riemann found out. Now, I want to just try and give you a little picture of what the zeta function looks like. But it's hard to do because it's a function. It takes a complex number and then maps it into another complex number. So you have a two-dimensional plane as a domain and a two-dimensional plane as a range, and you can't, you know, it's just, it's tough to see. So, but here's a little device that kind of helps somewhat. So we've got our two planes, the S plane and then zeta of S. And so in real time, you watch a little movie. As you're moving up here with values of S, you see how zeta of S then behaves, right? And so it's wandering around like that. Now the point we're interested in, zero. So where is zero in the complex plane? Well, it's right here at the, you know, at the intersection of the two axes. And so as S went up the 0.4 line, zeta of S sort of wrapped around the zero point like that. Well, let's try it up the 0.6 line and see what it does. Okay, well, now it's coming around, but not quite making it over to zero, right? The other one was wrapping around. Okay, well, we tried the 0.4 line, and we tried the 0.6 line. Why don't we try the 0.5 line? Let's see what happens. So can you see that in the green there? Yeah. Okay, so here it comes. Oh, look at that. It went right through. You see that? Right through the zero. Isn't that brilliant? Every time it comes around, it goes right through zero there as you're going up the half line. And, okay, let's see. I know you like that so much, so let's do it again. With all three of them.
Is this mathematical?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was, I mean, so you can see real time how fast you're going up and then how fast the thing
so
was moving.
So the plane was going up at a fairly constant rate.
Constant rate, yeah, and move, by moving around.
It's traversing the space, it's moving in and accelerating.
Right, and well, yeah, so it's not, I mean, yeah, and as you get higher and higher up the line, it actually moves, it can go really fast. But that's kind of predictable, how it's predictable sort of how fast it goes as a function of the height. Like log t basically times. Okay, and so this is the Riemann hypothesis, is that all the complex zeros of z of s have real part equal to 1/2, and from Riemann's formula for the number of primes in terms of the zeros of z of s, this is exactly the thing that would explain Gauss's conjecture, and so this is the thing that we want to know, is to prove that all the zeros have real part equal to 1/2. Here's Riemann's, here's a manuscript, a handwritten manuscript of Riemann's 1859 paper. It's just an 8-page paper to the German Academy of Sciences on his induction there. And he didn't actually give it. It eventually just appeared in sort of the proceedings, so he didn't get to speak there. But in there, here's his statement. Now, he's rotated things and made this xi function. So it's rotated by 90 degrees, and so he's talking about the zeros being real instead of on the half line. And he says, he's calculated how many zeros there are, and he says, now one finds that, in fact, there are this number of zeros between these limits, and they're probably all real. And so that's the statement of the Riemann hypothesis. And this is a thing, actually, at AIM, we just got a copy of this, or an original one of these things, which is that proceedings from 1859 that contains the paper. And just curiously, look at who the person who received the thing was. Enka was the same Enka from the Gauss story. Now, so I told you about the, you can actually make a, you can do this with mathematics or whatever algebra program you like, calculating program, and do that like zeta 2, that alternating series, 1 minus 1 over 2 to the s plus 1 over 3 to the s, and do that with up the half line, s equals half plus it, and just with a small number of terms, 15, you get this. And you can start to see already the zeros. There's a 14, 21, 25. So it comes out sort of right away. You can see these zeros almost right away from just a very small calculation. That you can, or you can do it with your graphing, with a graphing calculator even. So that's kind of cool. Now, you probably are wondering, on that green thing, I said it was going right through. Well, how do I know? You know, what if we focus in there and zoom way in? How do I know it really is going right through that thing and not, missing it by just an infinitesimal amount or something? Well, because of Riemann's functional equation, you can multiply the zeta function by something that doesn't have any zeros and turns zeta into a real function on the half line. And that's Hardy's function z of t. So this is a nice way to look at it. Z of t has the same zeros as zeta half plus it, and it has the same absolute value. And so the rotations, the distance you are from the origin, is reflected here in this z of t. And so that's how we know the zeros really are right on, because now it's a real valued function, and you just need sign changes to detect zeros. So here's the first up to 50. You can see about 10 zeros there. And here's also a stretch of 50, but up at a height of 1,000. And you can see a lot more zeros. So it gets more and more complicated as t gets larger. And here it is, just a sort of a funny place around 1,000,000. You're just sort of going along, and all of a sudden it just gets really huge. And there's a complexity to the zeta function that we have not been able to grasp up till now. And that's why it's, in some ways, it's the last elementary function that we don't understand. And that's one of the reasons, well, of course, it's connection with primes and all that, but one of the reasons it's so tantalizing is it really is sort of an elementary function, but we really don't understand it. We don't know where its zeros are, and we can't explain a lot of the exotic behavior. And so these 14, these are the zeros, half plus I times 14 and so on. These are the first few zeros. There's infinitely many of them, so you can't just check by computer. They get denser and denser as you go up, but what we want to know is that the real part in every case is exactly 1/2. And that's the Riemann hypothesis. People have done enormous calculations, starting with Riemann himself, but Graham calculated the first 15 zeros are all in the half line. All the way up to, you know, 5 years ago, people calculated that the first, what is that, million, billion, ten, first 10 trillion, the first 10 trillion zeros are all exactly on the half line. So that's a... Well, it's like t divided by around 2 pi t divided by log t. Yeah, I don't know exactly what that is, but yeah. So it's yeah. The number of zeros up to height t, n of t, is like t over 2 pi log t over 2 pi e plus, I don't know, something pretty small, big O of log t. And so you just take the inverse of that function. So it'll be around t over log t, but with a constant 2 pi. So I think the answer is 2 pi times t divided by log t, where t is 10 trillion. Okay, there's an elementary version. If you take the Mobius mu function, and this is, if you take a number n and you factor it into primes, if no primes, if a prime repeats, you get zero. But if no prime repeats, you just take plus one if it's an even number of primes and minus one if it's an odd number of primes. And this gives you the mu function. And so here's a little table, one, minus one, minus one, four, because that's two squared is zero. And so it's always plus or minus one or zero. And it's kind of a random, it's almost a coin toss kind of thing. And you can ask, well, if you add these up for all n's up to some quantity, what do you get? Well, here's a graph of adding those mu of n's up to around 10 to the sixth or so. And here's the square root function, square root of x. And that would be another way to say, another statement of the Riemann hypothesis would be, if this sum doesn't grow faster than square root of x times, say, some power of log x, then that would imply, and is equivalent to the Riemann hypothesis. But and in fact, Stilches claimed that he had done just that with the Mobius function, had found a proof that it didn't add up to any more than the square root of x. And this is in 1885. And this got published in Comte-Rendu, several notes claiming that he had the proof. And nobody really called him on it. And so Hadamard, in 1896, when he actually did prove the prime number theorem, and he wrote his paper, he sort of apologized. He says, well, I know Stilches has already proven the whole Riemann hypothesis, and all I'm doing is a prime number theorem, but I'll present this modest note anyway. And of course, there's De La Poisson. And so Hadamard, so by the way, he lived to be like 90, nearly 98, and he was about 96. And well, the prime number theorem, it turned out that it's equivalent to zeta actually having no zeros on the one line. Okay, so we have the critical strip, and you know, here's a half line, and here's the one line. So we know there's no zeros to the right of one by the Euler product, but what about right on the one line? Well, the depth of the prime number theorem is that there's no zeros on the one line. The Riemann hypothesis says they have to be all the way over to the half line. And so mathematicians started to think, well, if the prime number theorem is equivalent to there being no zeros on the one line, then we could never have an elementary proof of that. It would have to be involve complex analysis. And so there's a psychological belief that that were the case. But in fact, let's see. It will turn out that that actually wasn't the case. But I'm going kind of chronologically here. In 1900, Hilbert gave a list of 23 problems for 20th century mathematicians to work on. And one of them was the Riemann hypothesis. And that one's problem number 8. That's still not solved. Hilbert once said, if you woke from a sleep of 500 years, that's the first thing you'd want to know, is whether the Riemann hypothesis was solved. Just to show, I mean, you know, people ask, well, when do you think it's going to be solved? And you know, you just can't tell, because, I mean, who knows where the proof's going to come from, how difficult it is. And at one point, Hilbert, he gave a lecture, and he said, some people in this room will live to see Fermat's last theorem proved. No, he said, the Riemann hypothesis would be solved in a few years. Some people would see Fermat's last theorem proved, but nobody We would never know if 2 to the square root of 2 is a rational number or an irrational number. That question is just so hard we wouldn't know for thousands of years. Well, guess what? It's just exactly the opposite, except hopefully the Riemann hypothesis won't be thousands of years. Littlewood got assigned the Riemann hypothesis for his PhD. Fortunately, he did get his PhD, but not by doing that. Hardy and Littlewood were British mathematicians that did a lot of work on the Riemann hypothesis, the Riemann zeta function, the early part of the 20th century. Hardy was really quite a character. He used to work with Bohr in Germany, and he was very superstitious, he didn't like crossing the English Channel. And so apparently one time he was going to visit Bohr, so he wrote a postcard saying that he had solved the Riemann hypothesis before he left on this particularly stormy night. And he was kind of at odds with God and thought that this would be insurance for the boat not to sink in circumstances so favorable to Hardy. Hardy was also the first person to show that zeta s actually has infinitely many zeros on the critical line. And just to show you that he really, this is a list of his New Year's resolutions 1 year. And as you can see, the Riemann hypothesis is very important to him. It's number one on this exotic list. Yeah. 046, yeah. Now, actually, when I was in Göttingen, I got to see Riemann's notes. They have his notes in the library, too. But his papers weren't quite as neat as Gauss's. And, you know, he would have square root of 2 calculated by hand at 10 decimal places on pretty much every other page, and he'd sort of forgotten where he'd left it before. It was amazing. And his written stuff is so neat and elegant and concise and to the point, and his notes are just really all over the place. Here's an early table of zeros back in the 40s from the London Math Society. This first column is zeros. Okay, Selberg did find an elementary proof. I was talking about that earlier. In 1946, he found an elementary proof, much to the surprise of people. And he lived to be 90 and just died a couple years ago. And around the same time, Erdős also gave an elementary proof of the prime number theorem. There's actually a little bit of controversy between Erdős and Selberg. But you may know Erdős as one of the most prolific mathematicians with more than 500 co-authors. Selberg only had one co-author. It's kind of interesting contrast. And Erdős also lived to be quite old. And at a time in the 60s, when all four of these provers of the prime number theorem were still alive, people thought that maybe proving the prime number theorem conferred immortality. Well, now it's believed that proving the Riemann hypothesis will confer immortality. Because he didn't have it.
When did they discover Stieltjes error?
Well, he never wrote it down. He never wrote a proof down. And nobody ever asked him to, where is it? Where is it? Let's see it. Yeah. Selberg proved that a positive proportion of the zeros are on the half line. So that improved Hardy's to just infinitely many. So in other words, a constant times t log t. And that constant got worked out in a dissertation by S.H. Min, and the number was at least one in every 15 million zeros is on the line, is what came out of that. Here are some books. If you study the Riemann zeta function, here are some research books. This is the Bible, the Titchmarsh, that's revised by Heath Brown. The Riemann hypothesis it has to do with the connection between addition and multiplication. And it's just something that we just basically don't understand yet. And I just want to sort of illustrate it with kind of a simple version of it. So take your favorite prime number and here it's 5, and put, this is a circle, and make arrows at the numbers around the circle, 1 through 4, and then 0 we won't count. And if it's a square number, make an out arrow, and a non-square number, make an in arrow. Okay, so 1 and 4 are squares, so they get out arrows, and 2 and 3 are not. Now, these are squares mod 5. So we'll do, you know, 1, 4, and then you go around 9. Well, 9 is the same as 4 and so on, but so those are just the squares. And now, if you add those up, those vectors according to the way the arrows go, you wind up on the circle of radius square root of 5. Okay, and you do the same thing for 11. Out arrows on the squares. And this time the squares are 1, well, 3, because 5 squared is 25, which is the same as 3 mod 11, right? And so, and that winds up here on the circle of radius square root of 11. And there's 17, 61, and so on. And that's actually true. You can prove that it always winds up there. And that 1/2 in the square root, that 1/2 power, is actually related to the 1/2 line for the zeta function. And so this is sort of a finite example of a Riemann hypothesis. And in fact, there's a very, very elaborate version of this that was proven by Dalin in 1974, and he won the Fields Medal for it. And so we know the Riemann hypothesis for these finite zeta functions, but we don't know it for any of the other zeta functions. Now, I want to talk about Levinson for a second. So here the green things are zeros of zeta, and the blue ones are zeros of zeta prime, the derivative. And basically, they move to the right. And in fact, the Riemann hypothesis is equivalent to having all those zeros to the right of the half line, the zeros of zeta prime. And Levinson and Montgomery showed that there was basically a correlation, a one-to-one correspondence between zeros of zeta prime to the left of a half and zeros of zeta to the left of a half. So he then estimated how many zeros of zeta prime could be to the left of a half, and then came up with his famous work that at least a third of the zeros are on the critical line in 1974. And then he died. He had a brain tumor when he was doing all this work, and he had all these ideas just right at the end of his life, and he actually had an idea. He showed that he had an idea for showing that at least 70% of the zeros, and he sort of sketched it out here, but I haven't been able to figure out exactly what he meant by this, and so it didn't go anywhere. And so I started working on it for my thesis, as Ivar said. My thesis, I got up to around 36%, but then later, I got up to 2/5. So 40% of the zeros are on the half line. And so we know that that's true now, that, well, 2 in every 5 of the zeros are on the line. And the Clay Math Institute in 2000 made these millennium problems, these 7 problems, each worth $1 million, right? If you solve any of them, then you get $1 million for it. And so when they did this, I went to the Clay Institute and approached them and said, you know, asked them if they'd give me $400,000. They didn't. So one of the Clay problems was solved, the Poincaré conjecture. Maybe you heard about that. He didn't take the money and he declined the prize, but he did solve the problem.
Go back and ask him again. There's some money sitting
there. Yeah, that's right. but it turns out, earlier this year, February 22nd, together with Hung Bui and Matt Young, we made a very tiny improvement and got that 40% up to 41%. In fact, 41.05%, just barely over 41. And so we posted this on the archive. Now, that previous result was 1989, so, you know, we're talking 20 years, and this was the first improvement in this thing in 20 years, right? Well, 5 days later, somebody else posted a paper on the archive where they got the percentage up to 41.7%. So now this paper hasn't been refereed yet. The idea looks pretty reasonable. But anyway, I thought it was kind of strange that that happened. I mean, it was whatever. Some popular books on the zeta function have appeared in recent years. This is a really nice one, The Music of the Primes by Marcus de Satoy, and Prime Obsession, that's a great one. You can find these in your local bookstore. And yeah, they're interesting. They have some math and some history and lots of good stories, and they're pretty good. Now, here's Selberg. I have a video clip of Selberg at that conference in Seattle and that lecture that Ivars is mentioning. And I just like to play this because he makes sort of a controversial statement here. So here's Selberg at that meeting.
I'm also convinced that Friedman did know that Zebrais had no zeros on the line sigma equal to 1. A where 1, it would have to be a simple zero, of course. And
Well, so the point of that is he's claiming that Riemann knew the prime number theorem and that he could prove it, you know, before Hadamard and De La Vallee-Poussin, but he just didn't want to. And then he goes on and sketches what he thinks would have been Riemann's proof. So that was, I don't know, that was kind of interesting. Interesting talk. Here's a picture of 1 over zeta of s, and that accentuates the zeros and turns them into poles. And I actually had to look hard, slightly hard, to find a place where they were evenly spaced so that in mathematics all the heights actually came out the same, but that's kind of a pretty picture. Here's a graph of the real part of zeta, and this is actually the first place where you sort of have this strange, where you begin to see some of the complicated behavior. You have sort of one of these things loops around another one, and we know that they can get as complicated as you like. You know, you can have as many of these sorts of loops as you want. In fact, zeta has sort of a universality property. If you took any analytic function and took it in a small box, that has no zeros, you can find a place up the critical strip where zeta differs from that whatever function that was by less uniformly, every pointwise, by less than any given number epsilon. So it has this universal property, that universality property that imitates every single function. Here's a plot that shows, again, the zeros being the connection between zeros and primes. Earlier I showed you a graph that showed peaks at the primes when you summed over zeros. Here, you look at the error term in the prime number theorem and do the Fourier transform, and you get these very sharp spikes at the zeros. And so that sort of shows this duality between the set of zeros and the set of primes. Hilbert and Polya once said that they thought that you should interpret the zeros as eigenvalues of an appropriate operator. If it had the right symmetry, that would force the zeros to be on the line. And Lisko wrote to Polya to ask if that were really true when Polya was still alive. And Polya said, yes, he spent a couple years in Göttingen. Everything happens in Göttingen. Around 1914, he was trying to learn analytic number theory from Landau. Landau asked him if he knew a physical reason for the Riemann hypothesis. And that's when Polya said that, you know, if their properties match symmetries and the zeros were the eigenvalues, then you could have all the zeros real, like in the version like that Riemann said in his paper. And in fact, there's been some interesting developments with this with random matrix theory. And you look at sort of these large orthogonal matrices, and you look at their eigenvalues, and they're all in a circle, and you look at how they're distributed. And physicists studied this because it looked like like spacings of energy levels from sort of excited nuclei. If they were random, they would have had this, but physicists produced data that's here that matches sort of the random matrix distributions. And there's a classic book on random matrix theory. And my advisor, Hugh Montgomery, actually made a connection of this with the zeta function. He was a graduate student in Cambridge, and he discovered a formula for how, if the Riemann hypothesis were true, how the zeros should be spaced apart as you go up the line. And he flew over to St. Louis to give a talk on this there. And on the way back, he stopped at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton because he wanted to show it to Selberg to see if Selberg already knew this, because Selberg knew lots of stuff and didn't always publish everything. And while he was there, Chawla, who, by the way, was the only co-author, I told you Selberg only had one co-author, it was Chawla, made Montgomery talk to the famous physicist, Freeman Dyson, and tell him what he'd done. And Dyson said, well, you've basically... what you've discovered about the spacing of zeros of zeta are just like the eigenvalues. And actually, Montgomery sent me this recently. He'd lost this note, but it was a note from Dyson to Selberg, Atlee Selberg, telling Montgomery to look in Maida's book on these pages to find out, because Montgomery didn't know what sort of pair correlation was or what random matrix theory was or any of that stuff. And so it was really quite a remarkable event. And just to sort of give you a picture for it, if you were to just throw darts like randomly at a circle or something, I mean, if you just plop points down independently and randomly on a circle, you get a Poisson distribution, and this is what it looks like. That's random right there. And notice it's all clumpy and big spaces and all that. Whereas if you took eigenvalues of a big orthogonal matrix, they look like this, all kind of nicely, a nice pleasing distribution. Well, if you take zeros, oops, what happened to my, oops, oh, shoot. Oh, I lost my, oh, darn. Okay, well, for the zeta function, it looks exactly like the random matrix theory. You just look at it. If you took zeros and put them out like that, you can just see instantly that it's this, and it's not that. And there's a big graph that Lizko made sort of showing the random matrix paracorrelation function with the scatter plot is actual zeros of zeta, and it's just an unbelievable matchup. And so there's some hope that you could somehow use physics like this. And this is actually a letter from Enrico Bombieri, a permanent member at the Institute. And he says, this is when Alain Kahn, both Fields medalists, Montgomery and Kahn, he's writing this email. Kahn gave an account of how to obtain a trace formula, zeros, Bayes explicit formula, Riemann hypothesis could be solved if you did something. Well, a young physicist saw one could set the whole thing in a combinatorial setting using supersymmetric fermionic bosonic systems corresponding to a mixture of anions and morons with opposite spin. Well, it was an April 1st. It was an April Fool's joke. It went everywhere, and a lot of people got fooled by it. The whole random matrix connection has been developed much further in recent years, and it turns out there's this unbelievable parallel between studying zeta function and even the value, not just zero spacings, but the value distribution all matches up, and that's been a big source of research. It doesn't bode well to prove the Riemann hypothesis, but it's definitely let us understand kind of what's going on with the... What's that? Yeah. John and Miranda. Okay, I'm going to close with two clips here. Okay, one from Numbers. Anybody seen Numbers? You seen Numbers, yeah, okay. Maybe you've seen this episode.
I told you people to leave. Do you even have any idea what you're looking at?
Yes. You're making significant progress toward proving Riemann's hypothesis.
Yeah, very good. You know something about advanced number theory?
Sorry, I should have introduced myself. My name is Charlie Epps. I'm a professor at Cal Sci.
I should have recognized you. I attended your lecture series on Pieper's MP a couple years ago. Oh. Work showed a certain insight.
Where'd you get your degree?
I studied at Cornell, but I never finished my doctoral thesis.
You've obviously done amazing work here. You should have it published. Get it out into the math community.
Yeah. I actually have the solution.
You can prove Riemann's hypothesis?
After 15 years, I should hope so.
Okay, and this is the last clip. And this is my advisor, Hugh Montgomery.
So Sweet Betsy from Pike is a traditional folk song for which Tom Apostle has provided words pertaining to the Riemann hypothesis. I only know the first verse. Oh, where are the zeros of zeta of S? GFB Riemann, he made a good guess. They're all in the critical line, said he, and the density's 1 over 2 pi log t. That's it.
You can learn more.